Before this is each talking about character voice. So if this isn't the panel you want to be in, now's the time to leave. But don't leave. So we'll start over here.
Okay. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in the States. I teach creative writing and fantasy fiction, and I'm also an author. My first novel came out last year from Five Star Press, and I have two more novels out on submission. And I'm also co-editing an anthology on politics and speculative fiction with a number of authors who are not on this panel that I see, but that are at this convention. And so that's me.
My name is Hayden Trenholm. I have two books out to Parts of the Steel Chronicles. The third one will come out this fall from Bundoran Press. When I'm not writing science fiction, I am a policy advisor to a Canadian senator.
My name is Kate Story. I'm a writer. This is my first novel. Blasted. It is for sale in the dealer's room at the back of table. I don't know what else to say about myself. I do also have a background in theater as a dancer and an actor. And I'm a Newfoundlander as well.
Okay. I'm Grant Carrington. I'm a has-been who's almost a never-was. sold a bunch of stories back in the 70s, one of which was a nebulous prize, so I had a nebulous loser pin. My one novel, Times Fool, these are the old copies you'll see, I'm sure, 30 years old. But I do have three copies if anyone's interested. They said we're not supposed to sell these here, but they didn't say you couldn't sell your CDs.
No, they didn't say that.
This is not Philip, although there's one UFO song. That's only 10 years old, if anybody's interested, which I doubt. I also have a fair amount of theater experience as actor, lighting technician, and have had five plays produced.
Okay, and I am Karen Malachi, and I'm a novelist. And I have four books out, and this is my fourth one that just came out this month through Orbit. And that's basically all that you all need to know. the description of this was about character voices and how to keep them distinct without resorting to stereotype in your writing. And I wanted to be on this panel because my first three novels were all first person and from different points of view. So, but they're all linked. I call them kind of like a mosaic series. So the three distinct characters made up a fuller story when you read the novels. And so I was obviously very interested in writing voice, make it all different, because you're dealing with three completely different people. And how do you make their personality come through in the writing and keep the authorial voice as much out of it, because I write very psychologically. So that was I'm very passionate about that, especially if you write in first person. I'm just going to say one of my pet peeves, and then we can all kind of like spread around on what we think about the idea of, you know, staying away from stereotype. But one of my pet peeves in reading first person in novels is that it tends to sound, I really don't like it when first person sounds like third person replaced with I. I think that's really lazy as a writer to do, because the first person inherently is about having a distinctive voice, that it's someone telling the story, and it's your character telling the story, so it really shouldn't be you, and it shouldn't be necessarily distant unless the character is sort of distant. So that was one of the things I was exploring in my first three novels, and not to say that you can't have distinct voices in third person either. So that's another part of it too that I got very interested in. But having distinctive voice in your writing is something that's really I love to explore and experiment with. So that's my take. Let's start back over here.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that my situation would be similar. My second novel is in first person, and my third. And my second novel, which is told from alternating perspectives, has two vastly different voices. And part of the intention of that entire series is to create one is very much like would remind you of sort of an Old West prospector. It's set on a dormant volcano on another planet, but, you know, still, Old West prospector. And being able to alternate that with a very sort of Queen's English kind of voice, which is the other character.
Don't be shy. Sit in the front. Come on.
The whole hour. You don't want to stand.
We don't bite.
There's no test.
So it was a similar challenge to try to go through and get the voices properly balanced as much as I can. And I agree with you that when you read something which clearly was third person and was converted almost find and replace style, the Microsoft Word, I want a third person one, that is problematic. And so keeping the voice consistent, and I find that the more unique you make the character, keeping the voice realistic and consistent within the character is very difficult. I should never have made my first character have dialect, but they did, and so the whole thing was dropping G's all over the place, and that's a pain to do, but it has to be done to keep the voice consistent. So.
Yeah, my own, these two novels have most between 5 and 7 point of view characters, one of which is in the first person, and the rest of which are in the third person. Which is one of the reasons why I had a hard time getting it published initially, because people said, you can't do that. And I said, well, I'm going to do it.
So I'd use a second person.
But it does get complicated because most of the characters in the book are cops. So there's a kind of similarity because they're all doing the same profession. They've got similar education. So creating distinctive characters then requires you to delve deeper into who the person is when they're not on the job. One of the techniques, it's interesting to say, without resorting to stereotypes, one of the ways you can actually make characters distinct is to play against stereotype, is present a character initially as, oh, this guy is this, but then you gradually reveal how he breaks every common view of what that means to be that. And that's one way. But when you have a lot of characters, there is this basic similarity, you have to work very hard on things like level of education, so the kind of word choices that different characters use. You have to work very closely on what kind of upbringing they had in terms of familial relationships. Was it a very close, tight-knit family, or were they people who were essentially just living together? Because that changes how people express themselves. And you have to also recognize that it's not just dialogue. You have to present people's, appreciation for music, what their sensual life is like. So some people may be particularly sensitive to sound. Others may have an appreciation for art. And all of those things allow you to create that kind of distinctiveness, which, as I say, when they're all cops, you really have to work hard to get that.
That's good. Initial thoughts?
So many. I almost wish I could ask everybody, like, why you're here? Because, are people here because they are writers or interested in writing, or is it more that you're interested in a particular writer on this panel?
Writing.
So you're coming from this, many of you are coming from this as writers. Okay. Because I would assume that. I would have assumed that. But I think for me, I'm sure that my theater background is a big thing with my writing. I know that characters tend to... Everything I write seems to start with an intellectual idea, something I'm interested in, some research I've been doing, historical or concepts, or some kind of very, sometimes quite esoteric idea. So I'm messing around with it. In the case of this book, my first novel, it was... I was researching changelings. My brother at the time was doing a sociology degree, and he was researching fetal alcohol syndrome. And I was so struck by the similarities between the descriptions of changelings and babies purportedly suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome. But isn't that interesting? But that's very intellectual. It's not an interesting novel. And I wrote a dreadful short story. Horrible. And then I tried to write a play. It was awful. And then the main character of this novel, Ruby Jones, seized me. And it was that experience. And I have heard other writers talk about this, so I wondered if it was... an insane experience. But anyway, she really sees me, and she's like, this is my story. You are not, stop, blah, blah, blah. So it's been the first person. She refused to have it written any other way. I agree with you completely. The first person has some limitations. I think that, for example, this character is an addict. She's a chaotic person. She's a young person. So she has some pretty big blank spots in her perspective, and the reader may pick up on things. So that's something I was playing with as a writer, to keep that voice authentic. She's not going to have a lot of self-reflection, but how do you make that not irritating for the reader? So that was something that came up for me a lot, writing that. My second novel is from two different people's point of view. and mostly writing about a third character who is a bit of a tornado, you know, so the effects that those kinds of people can have on. So then that was it became a different kind of thing, and I wrote those in the third person. But I do, maybe because I'm an actor, I do hear them very clearly, and I sometimes will mutter away to myself, and I do hear them. And the only other thing I'll say is I have found writing groups or trusted advisors to be invaluable. So, for example, there's a character in this book who's Cree, so I had a friend who's Cree, another friend who's Ojibwe, quite different, but I did ask them, would you mind reading this and make sure I'm not doing the stereotype thing? I just was so worried. I'm a white person. I was like, I don't want to do like some dreadful pastiche, you know, and I wanted to be respectful of those people's biographies. So that was helpful. And then my second novel, one of the characters is male. So I really wanted to make sure, so I'm getting all my guy friends to read the book. So
you're not all the same.
You're not all the same. No, but I wanted to make sure that there's not some subtle thing that a male reader would go, you know, her name's Kate, it's a female writer. You know, and so in a way, I think it's good to do a bit of research that way. I personally think it never hurts to get some trusted advisors.
I've always written men easier than women, so I've never had that. It's just weird.
I don't have a problem writing them. I just don't want to make a mistake, you know what I mean?
No, I fool male readers. And it's funny. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that women writers have an advantage over male writers is there's so much male literature in history that you have that to draw on. We have less to draw on when it comes to women, although we're getting quite a bit. I came to the conclusion long ago that every character is a stereotype somehow. After writing things, and somebody said, that character's a stereotype, and it never occurred to me. Mine is just to go ahead and write and see what happens. In the short story, you usually wind up with a character who's not very deep and is closer to stereotype because you can't develop it. I find lately when I've been writing, not than ever with this book, which was my second book that I wrote, I have 10 unpublished novels, not all science fiction. And I find that when I get into a novel, usually by page 50, I'm not writing a novel anymore. It's being written through me. This is dangerous because sometimes you write crap that way and you don't realize it. But that's, again, where having someone else to read it who you trust helps. And a lot of times I will start characters from people who I know and then they grow into something completely different. In the last novel I wrote, which is not science fiction, not published, I have a friend who is 6'6" and plays a zillion instruments. So I have a guy who plays a zillion instruments, it's 5'4". I call him Harlan Ellison. So what happened? I met a guy who's 5'4" and plays a zillion instruments. Can't win.
I wanted to pick up on something that Kate said about, I always found it interesting talking to actors and kind of finding out their process, because I have this thing that I do and I call it method writing. And it's basically... it's basically the whole Daniel Day-Lewis thing, except it's in writing for me. And so if I get in the head of a character that, my third book, he was a criminal and a pirate and just a really not, a very, very dark headspace. And it's really good for the writing, but it's not so good for you. But the reason that I bring it up is because I think the more that you understand your characters psychologically, the stereotyping, being scared of a stereotype almost becomes a non-thing, because it's just like if you're meeting somebody, you know, you have your first impression, you say, oh, they're like this and this, you know, they're a beatnik or they're a metalhead or whatever, you stereotype people. It's like a shorthand. I think that's natural to do. And so when you're creating characters, for me, the way to break those boundaries is to really delve into the psychology of this person as if you could sit down with an actual person and pick their brain. Read it like as if you can sit down and read every possible interview with somebody and delve into their childhood and actually try and find out what makes them tick. This is a process that actors do. They, you know, what's my motivation? I mean, that's like a kind of a quick phrase. But if you talk to actors or read interviews with actors or whatever, they basically try and build a history of their character before they even get to the filming process. So everything that they know about this character, and it's kind of like the Hemingway principle, the 9/10 is under the iceberg is under the surface. You can know, if you, the more that you know about your character, the more it'll be informed on the page, and you can make conscious decisions about their voice and the things that they like and those kind of cosmetic things. But what you, the 90% that you know that might never make it on the page does get informed through dialogue and through interaction, the back brain that you, the unconscious part of you that goes into your writing. I find that, that's when that's the magic that happens. I mean, I got to the point where I would know the character so well that in any kind of dialogue interaction on the page, I knew immediately if it was the right thing that they would say or not, like where you can take the authorial voice actually out of it and say, you know, they would never say that. So I have to change, the scene has to change because, and their interaction with other characters would have to change because this doesn't feel natural. Because I just, you know the person so instinctively, and actors do the same thing if they play across some other other actors and stuff like that in their role, they'll know, you know, well, this is, you know, they're not going to say that because they inhabit the role. And I think a great way to break out of stereotype and have distinctive character voices, whether you're writing in first, third person, or a combination of it, or you're trapped to juggle like 5 points of view in one novel, the way to do that is the more that you know about your character and you get into their heads, I mean, you really, you know, you really have to kind of get in there. And really know the people down to, and then all that stuff becomes second nature. You know, their quirks, and that's where you insert quirks and idiosyncrasies that we all have that you don't necessarily see 10 minutes after meeting somebody. If you know someone their whole lives, then you understand their quirks, and we should know our characters' whole lives. And I look at it on and off the page too. They exist when you're not writing them, right? They exist off. The scenes you put them in. You know, they're running all the scenes that you, all the kind of the director's cut scenes that you never actually write or don't get into your books. I mean, they're still interacting in those spots, you know, when you cut away, especially if you're dealing with multiple characters. What are they doing when the other characters are doing other stuff? Well, they're living their lives. So you as a writer should know all of that somehow. And it'll be informed in your scenes and informed in your writing. It'll become very second nature.
You can do it very formally. I mean, see, there's a common thread here. I also started off in theater as a playwright and director. I wasn't a very good actor. I tried, but I did a lot of directing and wrote a number of plays that I produced. And one of the things I took from that as a writer, I now, before I start writing a novel, I write an 8 to 15 page biography of the character. I have a whole list of questions I answer about them, about their, you know, their family history, their education, you know, all the jobs they've had, all that kind of stuff. I write a day in the life. I describe what, I mean, this would sound very familiar to an actor because it's the, you know, it's a method approach to actually do a backstory and write it out.
Yeah.
And it is quite valuable. It really does help. I'm not someone who ever gets taken over by my writing. I understand that that's a process, but for me, it's an immersion in a world, and I'm always conscious of what's going on. But again, you know, you have to be fair, I guess is what I would say, or honest, what Hemingway would call honest when you're writing. So you can't manipulate, you know, the situation to make the characters do things that is unnatural. There has to be a flow. But, you know, on occasion, I've gone back and because characters aren't contributing in the way that... And so I go and kill one of their parents. You know, I just rewrite their biography and, oh, gee, you know, when you were 16, your dad died.
Trauma.
Changes them.
It's a what if, you know, you introduce the what if this happened then, and then it could take the character in a new direction. And there are stuff online, like when you mentioned where you can look up, you know, a basic kind of character template, like that will ask you all those questions.
Right. You can find it on my website. I have my own.
I have trouble with those things.
It's a good
story. I did a backstory for that last novel I was talking about. And that really did something. I had a backstory for my main character. It's 20 pages long, single-spaced. It's not going to be published. Plus 15 for another and a couple others. And I wrote them all in first person because I wanted to get into each one of their heads. And I think that was important. But it's funny how much... Most of it was not used. A friend of mine who read what I liked told me how to fix the novel. And I didn't agree, of course. I agreed and said, I can't do it, though. He liked the backstory better. And, you know, and a lot of it was like, some of it was used, some of it was not used, but I realized sitting here, one of the first things is he talks about overhearing a conversation from his father who had been in World War II about his experiences. And when he was a young, like 60 years old, not supposed to be hearing all this stuff, which doesn't have anything to my character. But when his father shows up, I knew who his father was, the person he was, from that experience. And I think the father came across much better than anybody else, and he only has a couple of scenes. But as an actor, I'm old school. I'm not method. My job is to act. My job is to present something to an audience. I'm here for them, not for me. But I find that those things I say when I write, and the characters come alive and they're running through me. And as an actor, and as a quote unquote folk singer, I'm two people. One part of me is into it. Not always, but sometimes it happens. I get into it. And another part of me, who is out there, am I going too far? What's the audience reacting? What's happening? So, and even in the writing, the same thing as part of me saying, wait a minute, are you going too far? What's going on? But I find that again, now I spoke to one character and just said, no, I'm not going to fall in love with this guy. Not this easy. She did eventually. But she says, I'm going to fight. I knew if I had been writing it, it would have been, I hate you, I love you, you know. But she made it take a couple of hundred pages, which, of course, makes it much more, I think, real and honest.
I think you do have to be conscious of those things, particularly when you're writing and dealing with characters that you would not care for if you ran into them in another book, let's say. You know, when you're writing villains in particular, and not just villains that you enjoy writing, let's say, but villains that you find personally nasty. One of the sort of clearest marks when you're dealing with an amateur is when you come across someone that clearly the author hates. And it's not just a matter of, you know, you can certainly write a character that you dislike, but if it's obvious that you're writing the character, to use your term, manipulating them, to make them seem worse even to themselves, then you're running into a problem, right? There is literally no person who has ever existed who believed as they were doing whatever what it was they were doing that they were utterly unjustified in doing it. They may have had an action that they took which they said, probably I shouldn't be doing this, but in the back of their mind they were going, but the hell with you, this is what you deserve because I'm, you know, whatever that particular action was. And so when you see a character, a sort of two-dimensional prop, right, that is sort of looking at someone and evilly cackling and twirling the handlebar mustache, it comes across as false because there is no such person who cackles and twirls a handlebar mustache unless they're acting a role, and it's certainly not something that they personally believe in. So one of the things that I found is in the process of writing my work is when there's a term that Stephen Greenblatt, a famous critic and historian, a literary historian, uses to describe Shakespeare's work with characters, and he calls it strategic opacity, by which he means that characters like Iago, for example, have their evil in part because there is clearly dimensions to Iago which Shakespeare knows and we never will. Iago even says as much, right? He says at the end of the play, I will speak no more. Right, and you're left wondering why did you do this, and why did you? And you have speculations as to why, and you have hints as to why, and you have thoughts as to why. Those things are clearly there in the character, but he will only reveal what he wants to reveal, and that is a part of Iago's character to do that. So when I'm in the process of writing my work, I'm always sort of conscious of that myself, which is to say, characters need to have breadth even when they won't show it to you, and even villains that you would on the street pass by and say, I can't believe you're doing that terrible thing, or I can't believe, if you are going to write the villain properly, or write the character you don't like properly, you must be able to be sympathetic enough to them to get into their head first, and do right by them. And be fair in their representation. They will, if they are bad people, still be shown out to be bad people in the end, but they will be well-realized, fully well-rounded bad people, as opposed to just being types that you put on a page. And so that kind of opacity, I think, is
villains
important.
Villains don't believe that they're villains.
Right.
They're the heroes in their own story.
Absolutely.
Love maybe a little bit strong, but I mean, I wrote a really despicable, the bad guy throughout the first three novels that I was writing of science fiction was a misogynist, pedophile pirate, and he, you know, writing anything scene with him was just ridiculously dark. But in his head, and I had him, you know, through the dial, but you never really see. I love the fact that, you know, the opacity thing, because it's true. It's really interesting that the reader, and the thing is, readers, I don't buy into, you don't want to spoon feed your readers, right? For me, books are like, the character building is a little like puzzles. that you put together, because you're trying to put together the reader's trying to put together the character and to get to know them. And so the reader shouldn't know everything. It shouldn't be laid out like a paint by numbers.
You should give them work.
The end of it.
They need to have work to do. Also,
they should be able to.
Yeah, they mystery. Need to have work to there's, do. Pat Rothfuss has a term. Pat Rothfuss, who wrote The Name of the Wind, has this term that he calls storytelling is the art of keeping secrets. And there's something to be said for that idea, that you are keeping secrets. And when he says it's an art, it's because you're not, keeping readers from information that they need to have. You're giving them an opportunity to find space within the world that you've created. And that's why if you do it right, you will end up with readers who will tell you, I really loved this particular character, even if you were a little bit, I don't know how this character is going to come off. If you've done the character properly, the reader will find that character intriguing nonetheless.
Yeah.
And that's indicative of the fact that you did do the amount of sort of, preparation, legwork, and sort of psychologically preparing yourself to inhabit that character as you were writing him or her. So
they have to be compelling, but readers don't necessarily have to like them
right.
all the time. I mean, that's I always. Think
but they have to believe in
they
them.
They have to believe in them, and the interaction should be. I always believe that the interaction with the character should be like how people will interact with people in real life. To me, that's the when I get readers who are spazzing out over characters and yelling at them, and why are they doing this and not doing this, and they realize that they're doing this or not. Not doing something because they're human, and then they look back and they say, oh, well, of course, if you wrote a perfect book with a perfect protagonist or a perfect villain, then they all did everything the way that they're supposed to. That's not interesting. Your character should be failing some of the time because we do, looking at all those dimensions.
And I think the interesting thing is that the appeal of fiction is because yes, you interact with characters like real people, but there's an advantage. Yes, you get to see inside their heads.
Yeah, exactly.
We're constantly trying to figure out what other people are thinking
and
why they're doing what they're doing. That's life, right? Why did my wife say that to me this morning? Was it something I did last night? I don't know. But see, with the character, I could wait a while, and eventually I'd get inside her head and say, oh, I forgot her birthday. See, and then you'd know. And that's why it's so great. But I wanted to pick up on what Kate said about cultural issues, cultural appropriation
of voice.
When I wrote this book, this is set 35 years in the future in Calgary, and if you don't have to know very much about demographics to know that 35 years from now, the majority of people in Canada will not be Caucasian. That's true in downtown Toronto now. The visible majority, as they call it. So much of science fiction, near future science fiction, is white. It's absolutely, lily white. And I said, that's just not what the future is going to look like.
Yeah.
The future is going to look like what, it's going to be different, The future is not just the past with better gadgets. The future is different. And so
non-stereotyping characters.
So trying to write a multicultural novel, so in this book, the main character is a 50-something white drunk detective. It's not me. I was never a detective.
I know so many of them.
I was never a detective. So, some of the other characters, one of the characters, as you can see, there are these creatures that look like cyborgs. Well, they are cyborgs, but the main cyborg is also Aboriginal. I've been fortunate. I've worked with Aboriginals for my entire career. I feel I can sort of do that. But at the same time, it's not a stereotype because managing an Aboriginal cyborg is somewhat different.
Cool.
But I also have, a Sikh character who's having a crisis of faith. So I had to go out and I had to, talk to some Sikhs. I had to find out what it meant for a Sikh to lose their faith and whether or not they could return to it and how that would work and whether it would be accepted. I had to understand what the basis of the Sikh faith was in order to try and depict that accurately. And yet at the same time, recognize that a person is not that category.
Yeah.
He's not a Sikh and that's it. He's a person who has, family issues, has personal issues, has likes, dislikes, motivations, ambitions, desires, and so on.
So you're not playing culture bingo, where you're just
ding,
right. ding,
right.
I win.
I
win the cultural award.
They're still all people, and they exist within, yes, they're shaped by their history and their culture, and their religion, and their relationships with other people because of the way multiculturalism works, but they're also people, you know, and ultimately you have to treat them as human beings that, you know, have their own thoughts and desires.
I'd like to pick up on that, what you were saying about the fact that we are able to deliver as writers an interior view of somebody as opposed to theater, where Shakespeare can do that. He can get away with underwriting characters or any playwright to some extent, as long as the basic information is there, because actors come forward with their bodies. We're able to project a huge amount. And, you know, any single person in this room is more complicated than Hamlet, right? Like, he seems like the most complicated character on the stage, but we all have a bigger biography. But when you're doing fiction, I think you could still use some theatrical tricks. And I think the easiest one for me is, you know, as an actor, you always have to ask yourself, what do I want in this scene? What do I want? What do I want? And it's not, what does my character Miffy want? It's, what do I want? Because you really need to get into it. And I agree with you, not in the method-y sense, not in like, oh, it's all about me, but in order to identify fully with the character. So when you're writing, this works for me as well. Because it flags for me right away. If I'm reading something and the character is drifting off and asking about something, I'm like, you're... boyfriend is bleeding to death there, and you're asking about this. That doesn't make any sense to me, unless there's something in the biography of that character that he or she wouldn't care about the boyfriend bleeding. But then that's interesting. We have to find out what
she's
that
is. She's a psychopath.
Total psychopath. Oh, how long do you think it would take him to, you know. But this is a question you have to know. But if you keep asking, and think about the character almost like a part of yourself. What do I want? What do I want? It's a way to keep the voice more authentic and the thing about avoiding stereotypes is that we're all very interesting to ourselves, right? Everybody around the world, throughout history, into the future. You know, the cyborgs, too, I'm sure, are going to be very interested in themselves. So, you know, that subjectivity is alive in these characters, and you need to convey that to your reader, not in a spoon-feeding way, but a lively way.
Yeah, I love what you said about the future being not white, because I read something or whatever where they said, you know, in the past, the big impact that people would see as a representation of people was the, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon thing. Mm-hmm. But they were projecting in like 50 or 100 years or whatever, because of, you know, intermarrying and all that kind of stuff and immigration, that the face of the future was this kind of Asian amalgamation, you know, the kind of Keanu Reeves kind of look, which I thought was really interesting, and that would be the majority cultural face on the planet because of the way, you know, so many Asian people are coming into North America and are in Europe, and it's all mixing up. And so the majority of people are going to have this kind of look. And I thought that was really interesting. And that's something to be aware of, obviously, very basic things in the background of your character. Like, nowhere in my science fiction book did I ever, you know, say a race. I would describe the character, and actually just got in a conversation with a reader about this, where, you know, she was wondering what the heritage of all these people were, and I would describe them in certain ways, the shape of their eyes and things like that, but I wouldn't kind of use the common, you know, almond-shaped eyes and epicanthic folds type thing, but I would, you know, infer also from where they're from, you know, the language that's around them, what race they would be, and that a lot of it is a lot of mix, and it may be because I'm a mutt, and I come from, you know, Toronto has a lot of mutts. No one is just Japanese, no one is just, you know, Russian, no one is just Spanish. Everybody is, there's a lot of people who are a lot of things, and so their faces will look like something that's a lot of things. I mean, I get mistaken for at least three different cultures, and I'm not, you know, not any of them because I'm a mutt. So it's really interesting, you know, how to non-categorize your characters and to realize that in reality, people will be really difficult to categorize in the future if you're writing science fiction. You know, you can't just look at someone and know automatically necessarily what country they're from, you know, or where they're from.
Although that assumes a certain liberalism, because I think there are all people who hold themselves
yes.
for cultural and religious reasons.
Chinese, so. I mean, that they'll hold out for a very long time.
The other thing, too, about voice, and we were talking about, you know, getting inside people's head, is the use of self-delusion as a character type. Because
that's always interesting.
You know, most people do not know themselves as well as they think they do.
Yeah.
You know, and we all go through our lives going, da-da-da, I'm this, oh my God, I'm not. You know, I'm something else.
As soon as somebody says, I'm this kind of person, all my alarm bells are going off. Yeah. Even when I say it, you know. And
Yeah. unless they're a very rare person who is that self-conscious. But a lot of, yes, writing in layers, that was the other point I wanted to bring up, that just to touch on some stuff that people say, is that you have to almost be thinking in layers all the time when you're dealing with characters, because it's, and I teach writing too, and I always told this to my students, that you have to know, was it three or four things, the character has to know what, you have to know as a writer what the character thinks of themselves, what the character thinks other people think of them, what other people think of them, and then the actual objective truth. So as a writer trying to get into your character, you should really be aware of all four of those things on some level. You know, say it again, what the character thinks of themselves, what the character thinks other people think of them, what other people actually do think of them, and then what the objective truth is. If you can corner the market kind of thing with your characters on that level, then I think you will, you know, avoid the stereotypes, and the voices will become distinct. And the really cool thing about writing, even if you write in first person, showing interaction, is you get to show that. You know, other people react to your character depending on what they think they are.
Right.
And your character, the dissonance and the conflict, which is what drives story, right, and will drive character interaction, is conflict, either subtle or overt, is, you know, their impressions of themselves and then how other people will interact with them because of how other people think of them.
Which is, I think that's why it's difficult to sustain, you know, and of course it's been done, but it's not easy to sustain a first-person novel from one character's exclusive perspective throughout without a great deal of other interaction and information that's sort of being fed in. If you look at a book like John Gardner's Grendel, which is brilliant and still underrated, I think, one of the reasons, I mean, Grendel spends much of that book alone, you know, wandering around, wondering why am I here, you know, I don't understand why am I able to speak and the humans don't understand me, and then all that sort of thing. And so the way that Gardner does it is to sort of insert these little moments when he encounters the humans, when he encounters the dragon, eventually when he encounters Beowulf, obviously, where you get these little aspects that sort of develop parts of Grendel's character for you that you wouldn't be able to get through him alone. It also helps that Grendel is astonishingly psychologically rich. If you haven't read the book, go read it. It is really extraordinary. But it's necessary to have sort of that other information feeding in. The other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about this, when you were talking about working with students, is I find when I'm teaching my own courses, and I, especially in creative writing, what I'll get from students sometimes is a story that, you know, they've clearly thought a lot about, and they've clearly put a lot of energy into, and interest, and so forth, and it's flat. And the reason it's flat is because the characters are flat. You know, it's the Colombian drug lord character. You know, there was if you remember, there was a movie called XXX, Vin Diesel's attempt at James Bond, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there's a scene, I swear to God, in which he's running away on a bike, and there's this helicopter of people that I think have come to sort of attack this, what they think is this drug compound, and they see him, and it translates in English in subtitles underneath, "Look, there's the Colombian drug lord on his bike." And I'm just like, naturally, that's what they look, go get the Colombian drug lord. I mean, you gotta be kidding me.
One of them says, "No, isn't he a journalist?"
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. No, he's that guy. And you know, so, I mean, that's funny, but the truth is that when you see it in stories, it doesn't work particularly well. And what I'll sometimes hear from students in talking to them about this, they'll say, well, but this is based on a true story. And so my answer to that usually is, well, the problem with basing it on a true story, which they assume answers the question, you know, like, it's a true story. And I'm like, well, then in that case, it's not flat. Well, I mean, it is a flat, right? And unless you're going to give me a biography, like, for more, see my life. Like, unless you're going to do that, the only way that a true story actually works is if you begin to explain some of the things or allow the reader to explain for themselves, but give the information the reader needs to understand the character that you wouldn't know for yourself, i.e., if you were the character in that situation, as you said before, Kate, you already know your own motivations, you're interesting to yourself, you understand why you did what you did, so you don't need a ton of backstory to explain why you were acting in a particular way. But someone else doesn't know all that information, right? So if they read something about you, they're going to think, oh, it's ridiculous, that wouldn't happen. So it doesn't help just to call it a true story. It only works is if you can provide some of the layers and aspects that motivated you to do what you do, to show your work, to go back to old high school math terminology, right? To show your work in allowing the character to develop in the way that they do. That's the only way it's going to be a realistic sort of true story or not. One of the last thing I wanted to mention quickly, going back to the race thing quickly, Ursula Le Guin has said that she was always stunned that people had no idea that Ged is black in A Wizard of Earthsea. But he is.
He's black, and the characters that he made.
It's there in the book.
Absolutely, but she doesn't say, you know, Ged, who was African American, you know, or whatever. Yeah, Ged, who was of African descent, because no one would say that about themselves,
exactly.
And no one would, you know. And yet, it's clearly described as dark skinned at some point in the book, but it comes out organically. And
yeah.
we just assume going in that we're going to be dealing with, it's a wizard. Clearly, they must be white. Why?
Right?
And
but
so
it's on the cover.
Because it's on it. Right. And there have been examples of cases where covers demonstrate or show pictures.
Yeah.
Sci-Fi did this. When Sci-Fi did that dreadful Wizard of Earthsea movie, and they made Ged white and Ogeon black, which is precisely the reverse of what happens in the book. And that's an example of people not reading and not really paying careful attention to the things that are there.
Well, there have been the recent brouhaha about, you know, people of color characters being presented on covers as white.
Yep.
My publisher didn't do it, and I'm so glad that they did. I would have kept a mistake.
The problem with first person is you can't, if a character knows something that's important to the plot and what's going on, it's very difficult to hide that from the reader legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
And plenty of books or novels or even short stories. He knew that all along. He should have told us at the beginning.
Yeah.
And,
so if you're cheating your reader in some way.
There are some ways around that sometimes, but you got to be careful of that. The other problem I had with first person, I had the opposite problem with the first person. My characters are not self-reflective because I'm not self-reflective, which usually gets me in trouble three times a day. whoops, didn't think. But which is a problem for me is because my characters aren't self-reflective, then everybody says, I don't understand this guy. Why doesn't he think about this stuff?
But the trick of that is because my protagonist in the first novel was in absolute denial of everything that happened to him. So how do I? You have to, like I said, you have to think in layers. So you have to show really what's going on with him through his interaction with other people. How does he react with it? He was dealing with trauma. So for the entire novel, someone like that who's a kid who's not, you know, being sit down with a shrink isn't going to deal with it.
Right.
You know, they're going to run the other way. So how did I convey? And actually, you know, a lot of the my readers would be like, well, we didn't really get some readers who couldn't kind of read between the lines didn't really get what had gone on with him until towards the end of the book. And I said, well, that's kind of the point because it is first person, and he's only giving so much. But there are hints in the way that he interacts with people. You know, he wouldn't want to get close to people physically and that kind of stuff that are clues. And so there's ways to do that. I find first person actually, it is restrictive, but it's also very freeing because you're allowed to do things with character in the first person that you can't necessarily do in third person. And I find that to be so interesting, and you can really draw the reader in, you know, draw them into their heads and the process of your character, which is, you know, people will read for different reasons. The majority of people read for character. And so if you can actually present a character as that compelling, people will turn a page and they'll forgive, and trust me, I'm speaking from experience, they'll forgive plot issues. They'll forgive technical issues if the character holds up and the character is compelling. But you do have to think in layers when you deal with characters to avoid writing yourself into corners and to avoid handicapping yourself. But there's ways to do it, and a lot of it is through interaction. Because people reveal themselves through the way they deal with other people, and you can have a character who's not self-reflective. As I did in the first novel, he didn't want to think about himself. That was the last thing he wanted to do. And so how do you show actually the character that through that? And, you know, you can do it through that.
I just want to talk a little bit about process in writing. Because, you know, Hayden was saying that you actually do biographies and lay things out. I
don't have a watch. Can we just get it?
Yeah,
can we
check it out? 10 minutes? I think for me, when I write, and I'm working on my third novel now, and I've done a bunch of short stories. So I'm not, you know, I'm certainly still at the beginning of my writing career. But I feel like I'm discovering something. And I always go and write. I don't start writing the first chapter until I think I know all about it. And I start writing, and I'm like, well, I've just scratched the surface of them. Continuously, it's like I'm a journalist in this fantasy world, and I'm finding out about these people, about this world they live in. Your experience of having to go back and kill off somebody's parent? Absolutely, I've had that experience. Like, why is this guy such an asshole? I don't get it. And it's like, oh, because this happened to him. And it always comes to me like, oh, that's why. As if he's known that about himself all along, and I was too stupid to see it, you know? So that I don't. I'm not saying that's maybe the most efficient way to write, and I always wish I could map things out maybe a little more than I do. But for me, there is that feeling that I'm discovering things as I go along, and so then this, when you say thinking in layers, that comes later for me, where I'm the complexities are all there for me, and I'm discovering them. But then I have to start thinking about what's going to read for the reader, and that's where it starts. Like, what is conveying? Is this coming across? Is it working? And that has to come for me later in my writing process.
Well, there's two hemispheres with the writer. There's the organic part of it when you're actually writing, and then there's the editorial part of it. And you know, you have to balance when they come into play.
Yep.
And
then you just won't write if the editor's at the beginning.
Yeah, one has to come to the fore, you know, ideally in the beginning, and then you know, the editorial part that actually is being conscious of what you're doing has to come into play at some point too. And it, you know, they trade off. Maybe we should take questions from the.
If the more you write, the sooner the editor comes in. He begins to come in, he says, while you're writing.
I'm finding that, yeah.
You know, when you start out, it's they're almost different.
Yeah.
You have the organic part and the editor part. But as time goes on, as you write more, they begin to merge together. Yeah. And
you see yourself with your old...
And there's plus and minus.
Yeah, I did that again.
Yeah.
I did want to say one thing about process, is that I think everybody's process is their process.
Yes. Yes.
And,
exactly.
You know, whatever works for you. I mean, it depends on where you come from. I mean, my background, I don't have a background in English or, you know, I have a degree in chemistry and master's
Mine's
degree
a
in political science, right? So my approach to writing is shaped by my career as a policy analyst. So I tend to be highly analytical. I plot extensively. I know that, because I write mysteries. You cannot get away with
it.
Your plot has to be... Your plot can't be...
You can't cheat.
You can't go... like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, your process is your process. But I think one of the things about using multiple points of view and different first and third person, what it allowed me to do was... through the course of these books, you know, Frank Steele was the main character, but initially he sort of figures out why he is the way he is, right? You know, he knows who he is, but now he's trying to figure out why he is the way he is. Then the second book, he's got his self figured out, but then he's got all this issue around family, right? Because the point is that nobody is, even if you think you know what's going on, you don't really know what's going on. And I think part of the interest in character development, we call it character development. I really call it character revelation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's the character moves along thinking that I want this, or I believe that, or this is how my life is going to work out. And then through the events and the interactions with other people, things are revealed to him or her about who they really are and what they really want. And what's more, it's an ongoing process. It's an ongoing process, you know. Ideally, we all should, when we're, you know, laying there at 87 on our deathbed, go, you know, really, I was... that would be the perfect way to go.
Yeah.
It's still learning about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, even on the... I talked about this yesterday in a panel. Even in the case of mysteries or thrillers or very sort of plot-driven work, plot-driven work only works if you have a compelling character to drive it. If you think of two examples of movies which aren't traditionally considered to be character-driven, you'd have something like, say, The Bourne Identity and Die Hard, right? The Bourne Identity is this big spy thriller kind of this thing. It's character, well, it's character-driven, you know, on the outside of it, it would seem to be some kind of super spy, CIA tech kind of thing. What it really is, what makes it interesting, of course, is the character of Jason Bourne.
Yep.
One, because you don't know who he is at first, and then you want to find out why they're doing what they're doing. But two, even in his action sequences, the action sequences matter because of the things you learn outside of the action sequences, right? They matter because you care what happens to him. Best action movie ever made, in my opinion, is Die Hard. Die Hard's an action movie in which you have this guy who's not a very impressive-looking figure in Bruce Willis, who's kind of this sort of totally average Joe who's thrown in way over his head. And what makes that movie a fascinating movie is not the incredible popcorn-style action sequences, although those are fun. What makes them interesting is the fact that he sits there trying to figure out who and what he is now as this cop who's kind of always been rebellious and made errors that he shouldn't have made, and his relationship with Al, this cop outside the building. And it's the conversations he has with this guy that he's never even met and the interactions that they have with each other that reveals parts of both their characters that makes the action sequences matter. It's why you care. It's why you're not watching an intense
Nintendo, you know, sequence, but you're actually watching people that you care about get involved in things that they care about. It's also reasons why the best of the James Bond films are the ones in which you don't know as much about the character of James Bond. It's why Casino Royale, the new one, worked so well, because the character of James Bond becomes interesting again, instead of just a type playing with a gun. And that demonstrates that even things that are considered, you know, thrillers and mysteries and things which are supposedly plot-driven only work with a real character to drive the plot forward, I think. Not to mention the fact, by the way, it sells. Character sells. My agent picked me up because he loved the voice in my second book. This book was published because they loved the voices of some of the characters in the books. So character, I think, really sells even more than plot. They will cover a multitude of sins in that area.
So we just take questions for the last.
How do you decide first versus third person? Like what?
Oh, that's the character, and I have to try it out. Sometimes it's very immediate, and other times I write. I actually started this book in first person because I'd done the previous three, but it's a different genre, and I love the first person. I started it in first person. I was like, it's not going to work. I mean, you just know that. For me, it's very organic, and it's very. I feel it if it's work or it doesn't work.
I did have one short story where the main character was so troubled and intense. It started in the first person, and I thought it was too hard for the reader. That it was too much.
Yeah.
So then I switched it to the third person, and the story worked. But usually, I agree. It's organic, and the character seems to say.
Yeah, it's very hard to give one answer to that. It's the novel I'm working on now. A person that I trust very much in a writing group that I work with had suggested, you know, can you do both? And it's a story about a religious assassin. And so the various things that the religious assassin engages in when he's in these missions, it is in those moments then exclusively in third person. You're getting to see the cool stuff that he does. When he's outside of those missions, it's in first, with him thinking back to what it is that he did. So you're kind of zooming the camera in and out. But I could not possibly tell you, you know, he came up with that suggestion. In other cases, it just sort of fit the work. I do think that the broader the scale of what you're talking about, the more likely the third person works better, because it allows you more reach to get around what you're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're dealing with something which is a little bit more intimate, that is when I think you're going to have, again, to use the camera analogy, the sort of tight focus, you know, right over the shoulder type of thing, and first person may be called for. So the broader the scale, sometimes the more likely third person will be used, although not always.
The thing about third person, again, is you can't hide things, because you don't have to get into the heads of your characters if you don't want to.
Right.
But you have to be consistent about it. If you either are or you're not.
You could always use second person for those cases.
Oh, yeah, right.
Just refer to you.
No, thank you.
It's been done.
Yeah.
That's been done.
Sure.
I don't know if it's successful.
Sure. Not easy.
Yeah, sure.
There's a very good short story by Laurie Moore called How, which is written exclusively in second person,
American Psycho,
which is extraordinary and unusual, and works in part that way. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, technically, the Cask of Amontillado was told in second person, technically, because it's being told to someone specifically, you who so well know the nature of my soul, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a little frame on the outside.
But
Heart of
really,
Darkness,
it
too.
It is really first person.
But that frame is not as important.
I've done that scene.
Sure, I mean,
we're not ever thinking of it as being
that frame matters. Yeah,
Aiden has a comment.
It's funny too. I mean, one of the reasons my main character is in first person, because this is a noir style novel, and there's a tradition in noir, you think, that it's in first person. In fact, you go back and read most noir novels are written in third person.
Really?
Sure. You go back. You go to Dashiell Hammett. That's all in third person. But it feels like first person.
Yeah.
It feels like first person.
That's a cool thing too. It's to do a third person that feels like first person.
Yeah.
And I would suggest, I guess, this is my last comment, and we'll make last comments all around, is to read outside of the genre too. Even if you, because I find that a lot of in genre, it's a curious thing that sometimes that people aren't as willing to experiment with voice in the genre as much as it is outside the genre. You read what you can do with voice, like I say, Cormac McCarthy, which I'm really kind of getting into. He does, like, his stuff that he does is you know, ridiculous. It's almost like, you know, no dialogue quotes, and he just kind of breaks form all over the place. And I find that's sometimes outside of the genre, you will find writers who do that, and for me, that's like American Psycho, and, you know, writers like that, Chuck Palahniuk, and they just do really interesting thing that breaks the form, and when you break the form, you can also, that also informs the voice of your character too. I found it really interesting to kind of play with that too. How do you structure and the form of your novel can inform how your character sounds, no matter what point of view you write in. And I found that really to be interesting to do too. So.
Yeah, I would just along that lines. If you really want to see how to play around with point of view of a person, whether first, second, third person. How Late It Was, How Late, by Jonathan Kelman, which won the Booker Prize on a 5-4 vote. Because people who liked it a lot, and people who hated it despised it.
That's a great reaction, for a book.
What was the name again?
How Late It Was, How Late. And in it, Kelman actually uses all three, first, second, and third person, sometimes in the same paragraph. And it's amazing. It is the most amazing book. But you'll either love it or you'll despise it.
Yeah. See? Yeah. So, are we time? Do any last comments?
I think we have a couple. Yeah, I guess.
Last comment?
Last comment.
We had 2 minutes, but not
one. Okay.
One comment. I saw a great YouTube review of The Phantom Menace versus Star Wars. And the first thing they did was they said to people they were interviewing, describe Han Solo. And so most people said rogue, you know, bit of a pirate. Describe Qui-Gon Jinn. And everyone just sort of, and you had to describe them without saying what they looked like, or you know, what they're anything about their appearance. And everyone just stopped. And this guy said, "This is why Qui-Gon Jinn wasn't a good character compared to Han Solo." Yeah. And I've had fun back here. I'm late because I had to get coffee, and I couldn't see you three, so I had to try and guess your characters just from what you're saying.
Yeah,
which
like
was kind of
perfect.
It's like the Newlywed Game, isn't it?
Characters that you just sort of tried to, you know, not look at them and see what they're like.
I always know what they look like.
Yeah.
I know how they feel inside their skin, like whether they like themselves that way, whether they hate their bodies. I don't know. It's always very vivid for me.
They're not archetypes to themselves, so to describe them would be... I could describe them, like you can encapsulate anybody. I mean, give me 2 minutes, I can encapsulate Qui-Gon Jinn. I don't think it's that. You know, he's the mentor, he's the sensei. You know,
yeah, so. I rarely know.
We're told time is up.
Okay, we're told. So, well, thanks, and I hope you all got something out of it.